You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Page to Stage,
a conversation with theater makers.
We're your hosts.
That's Brian.
And that's Mary.
Join us as we focus the spotlight back on the theater maker to uncover their process.
We speak with folks in the industry that often aren't heard from,
such as stage managers, producers, crew members, marketing professionals,
and everything in between. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hello, my name is Carol Healy, and I am an actor, director, and a teacher. I also design a bit as well. And I've been in the theater for a very long time. I just got a notice from Actors Equity that I've been a member for 40 years. Well, wow. Made me feel very old.
And for all of our listeners out there, Carol was my voice and speech teacher in undergrad. And she's been somebody that I wanted on the podcast for quite some time. So I'm so, so excited to have this conversation, to talk all about your process. I think you have such an expansive now 40-year career, it seems. So I'm excited. But can you begin by describing the difference between voice and speech as it's related to the theatrical process?
And voice is the actual production of the sound that we make with our bodies. So that would involve breath, you know, first of all. And second of all, it would be that breath then coming up through your instrument and then basically vibrating the vocal folds here in the larynx and then using all of the bone and space in the face and the chest to create a resonance, which then sends the sound out into the theater or the space that you're in. Whereas speech would involve diction, enunciation, the taking of that reverberating sound and parsing it into bits that we understand as language. So it's not only the production of those sounds, and that's, you know, lips, teeth, tip of the tongue, but it also has to do with, now we're getting into the field of interpretation, also emphasis, stress, rhythm, the music of your language. And so all of that goes into speech. And voice can sometimes involve poetry, and we use text sometimes as we teach voice in order to take all of the sound being produced and put it into something. So there is some overlap in the two fields of study. It's just convenient, I think, for most academic and conservatories to separate the two, and then in the speech class spend more time actually on that enunciation part and interpretive part.
As you were just talking there, I like the top of my head got like goosebumps, which is such a weird thing to say, but it brought me back to my junior year of college. I totally forgot about this, but I took a voice and speech class as well in college. And just hearing you talk about like the voice like that, it just completely snapped me back to 2010 or whatever it was. But I'm curious, I remember we had like a journal, we had to like do exercises every morning as a group, but then also she had the expectation of us to do exercises on our own because it was a morning class. So she had us do exercises before we got to class and obviously as a group, are there anything that you do in your daily life that you would recommend to anybody, whether they're an actor, really utilizing that tool or not?
Because just for context, also, Mary did not go to school for performing.
No, I did not.
I would recommend it to almost anyone that has to speak in life, which pretty much includes everyone, just because, you know, there's a book that's written by a master voice teacher who just recently passed. Her name is Kristen Linklater. And the book that she wrote is called Freeing the Natural Voice. And so I think so many of us, you know, as children, if you look at a baby, for instance, in the cradle, and babies, you know, are the ultimate egomaniacs. They don't care if you haven't had any sleep. If they want something like food or a dry diaper or to be picked up, they just let their voices express what they need and what they want. There is no difference between what their objective and what they're demanding. Do you know? They're not sensitive to others' feelings. So that's the ultimate egomaniac. And we could say that a baby probably has one of the freest voices of all human beings. You notice they don't get laryngitis, even though they might spend a lot of time screaming. Because all of the apparatus, the larynx, the vocal folds, all of that are relaxed and free. And they're using their abdominal muscles, their rib cage, every part of their being is wrapped up in that demand or that need or that want. So that voice is very free. Then imagine a toddler going with his mother to the grocery store. And as they're checking out at the grocery store, the little toddler sees all of that candy. Isn't it funny how they put all that in the checkout line? And so the little toddler just reaches for it because now they have some autonomy, right? And they reach for that chocolate or the sweets. And the mother says, no. And the toddler looks and it's like, but I want it. I'm frustrated, right? So the toddler might express themselves and starting to have a temper tantrum, at which point the mother, horribly embarrassed, says, no, be quiet, shh, and starts to hush the child so that it doesn't create a huge public scene and a lot of people judging the mother or the father on their parenting skills. So the great sort of hush begins. And parents begin to use all sorts of techniques and tactics to kind of quiet that child down and teach them what we call self-control, right? And that continues through life. It's not just the parents. It also becomes the teacher, the nanny, the babysitter, the other children, which are the really strong. So then you start to get into junior high peer groups, and there's a lot of influence on people to sound a certain way, to either be, you know, if you're in a group of theater friends, you might be loud and expressive, like that's the way we talk in our group. Or let's say you're with a group of kind of like cool kids, and you know, like everybody talks like this, and you know, we like swallow everything back because that's the way we talk. And then you begin to adopt that voice, that speech, that whole way of being in order to belong, because that's your primary objective when you're a teenager, right? It's just let me belong. So by the time we get into, you know, a university or a conservatory situation, we're to the point where we're pretty much shut down. So my job and all of the voice and speech teachers in the world is to kind of help our students to find that inner child again, to use a kind of corny phrase, but to find the freedom to be able to express themselves again without all of the parental and societal pressures that have taken that voice and shoved it down. And actually caused us to become shallow breathers, to lose parts of our resonators because it's not acceptable to sound a certain way. Or so it's a process of really unconcealing the voice, you know, or if you were to use a sculptural metaphor, to kind of, you know, Michelangelo said every sculpture is already contained in the block of marble. It's just a question of unconcealing that shape, you know? And so that's what we have to try and do. And it's very hard.
I think also, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like at the college level, especially, you're not just dealing with people who are from the same area like you probably are in high school or younger. You're having students come from all over the world, even, you know, the country, but even also the world. So you even have dialects, you have accents, you have all those other things.
Well, I actually remember the first day of Carol's class, she asked my class to, I think, say a sentence or two, and she would try and guess where they were from in the country.
And
you were, yeah, I remember. And it was, you were spot on. You got everybody, you know, down to Dalton, who was from Mississippi. And I found that was so interesting. And that's also part of like the chipping away. But I think it's more of like going back to like a blank slate is neutralizing your own personal habits. Because people still tell me now after college, they say, wow, it doesn't sound like you're from New Jersey anymore. Like, what happened? It sounds like you have a very standard American accent. And I said, you know, if you really get me with the Jersey people, I'll start saying chocolate and dog and talk. And but I'm very proud of that I accomplished that in your class.
Yeah, it's important, I think, for actors to kind of come to a neutral place so that then they can go wherever they want. And, you know, in my class, we learned what Brian learned, Mary, was this what we called stage standard, which is really out of style now. In fact, I got a lot of pressure from, you know, administrative people to sort of stop teaching that because there were sounds in there that they said, oh, it sounds just so white, you know, like there's a sound that people don't use very much in general American speech. And that's what we call the ask sound. So it's like the sentence is, I can't ask Francis for half the dance. Whereas general Americans say, I can't ask Francis for half the dance. You know, it's much brighter. And so I had to fight to be able to teach that funny little sound, because my point was is that we also want to study, for instance, received pronunciation, which is, a you know, the British dialect, and they use I can't ask Francis for half the dance. And the ask sound is the sort of bridge in between, so it sort of falls in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So I think it's an, you know, it's fun to learn a sound, even if you might not choose to use it in a particular characterization. It's nice that you know, as Brian was saying, it was like you sort of have a palette to choose from as an actor. And just like you would say, you know, I think this guy is going to, I'm playing Richard III. And my idea of him is that he has, I don't know, you know, a back like this. And I'm gonna give him, you know, some walking sticks or something like that. Just like we choose, make those kind of choices as actors, we can choose from a variety of sounds and places to resonate from, and even breathing patterns to give an idea of character.
Can you think back to a specific process in your acting career where maybe things clicked into place a little bit for you in terms of voice and speech?
Yeah, because as an undergrad, I voice and speech was a pain in my neck. I just wanted to get to the acting, you know? And so I thought all of it was very pedantic, and you know, to sit in a chair for an actor and learn sounds, you know, Lee will let Pat pass. I was like, oh God, get me out of here. I want to do Chekhov and Shakespeare and Williams, you know. But what I think that there was this one time, I was actually just had finished my first year of grad school, which was grueling in the extreme. For voice and speech especially, and they were very adamant that you had to speak stage standard at all times, even when you were, you know, in a private conference with your faculty, you had to use stage standard. and it drove us all crazy. So I just wanted to be free. And I went out, I was cast at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, and I went out and we got to see Titus Andronicus. Was one of the productions. I mean, and it was great because how often do you get to see Titus Andronicus? And there was an actor named Ken Ruta, who was at the time, like, he was one of the great American actors. He did regional theater. Broadway people didn't know him that well, but oh my gosh, he was famous in certain circles, especially in classical theater. And this guy comes out, he was old. He was in his 70s, I guess. And he came out and his first line was, "Hail, Rome." And he stood on the stage, in the center stage, and I was out in the audience, and this is a replica of the globe they have, you know, so it's an octagonal theater with an opening at the top and a tiring house in the back and the whole thing. And when he stepped onto the stage, I was out in the audience, I felt my bones vibrate. Like, actually go like this. And I was like, what is that? And I'd never experienced it before, that I actually felt a voice as well as heard a voice. And I got very, very curious about this. And I also had gone to Carnegie Hall, and I had sat in the 10th row center. And, you know, I liked music, you know, but I wasn't a freak about music. But when I sat in Carnegie Hall and I had a full orchestra playing and I was in the middle seat in the 10th row because I was sitting next to the composer, I felt the music vibrating my bones. And it was a three-dimensional experience for me. It wasn't just my ears. It was my body experiencing the music. Just like when Ken Ruta said, "Hail Rome," my body experienced his voice. And I said, this is at a totally different level. This is like surround sound, you know, it's like Dolby or something like that. And I got very, very interested in it. You know, how do you make someone feel your voice? Not just like hear it, or it's not about making pretty sounds. There is a connection to our, the core of our humanity that's being drawn up, resonated, and passed out. And that's all we've got over film, you know, is that live presence. That's what we've got to give to a live audience. And that's why we go through, you know, all the pain in the neck of like getting a ticket or maybe traveling and waiting and going into a theater with a mask on. You know what I mean? Now it's so hard. But people go there for the presence of those actors so we can feel it instead of just having this kind of flat two-dimensional experience of film.
And I remember there was a play that we did at Montclair where they used microphones instead of just letting the natural voice speak for itself. I think back to that moment when I see a play now, and they're using microphones instead of just letting the voices carry through the space. Can you talk about that in the way that you were just speaking about the, you know, the production of TV and film and the, you know, the artificial nature of that?
Yeah. I mean, it's very tricky. It also has to do with sound design, which is just, I have a friend named, his name is Barry Funderburg. Isn't that a great name for a sound designer? And he talks a lot about this. He waxes philosophical quite a bit about, you know, because this is his job, is to kind of deliver this text. And all of us have noticed in this little group of friends that we're having a harder and harder time. And I don't think it's just age of hearing dialogue, even in films, you know, especially action films. I was watching The Matrix, I don't know which one it was, Reloaded or one of the sequels. And I was straining so hard. And we have like really excellent sound bar and, you know, with surround sound and speakers, you know, because my husband is just crazy for that stuff. And I had to go boop, boop, boop and go up all the way to 47 to hear the dialogue. But then my ears would get assaulted with the bam, crash, boom, and the back of, you know, that tension filled, telling me what I'm supposed to feel kind of stuff was like blasting me at 47. So I spend my time going this with the volume, this with the volume. And so what that tells me is that we're really being manipulated as audience people. You know, they're telling us this is a very tense moment, you know, or this is a moment of dread. I mean, look at the, like, bottom, bada, 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 da, 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 da. I mean, and we're like, ah, on the edge of our seats with Jaws, right? If we didn't have that, it wouldn't be just a girl jumping into the ocean and swimming at night, you know? But in the theater, hopefully we're not manipulating our audience quite so, it's so obviously. I think, you know, especially thinking as a director now, there is a certain trajectory that you hope the audience goes on. You want them to go on a journey, especially with the protagonist, the lead character. You're hoping that they walk with Lear onto the heath and welcome that storm on, you know. But that live presence is what is leading us there, hopefully, rather than that manipulative quality of the voice. And so when we use microphones, which I think sometimes, I think we're stuck with that because so little attention has been paid to sound in architecture. So we have a lot of dead spaces now where it's very hard to get a ping back, you know, like theaters aren't constructed for sound like they used to be. Like you look at, if you go into Carnegie Hall, you can really get that sense, or go to the Met. You know, it's like that's a huge orchestra, and those opera singers are singing over, I don't know what it is, a 75-piece orchestra. They're not mic'd. You know, a lot of young actors are now coming and saying, well, it allows me to be really subtle and really natural, so I can just, you know, say whatever and kind of mumble it. And there's a lot of that now. This, that naturalism, which is of course complete BS. It's the illusion of naturalism. I mean, what does the actor think? I'm not in a theater? That I'm really in Moscow in 18, whatever? No. It's the, we're giving the illusion of naturalism. Right? That's what's happening. Instead of, you know, my number one job as an actor, number one, especially when I'm speaking the words of William Shakespeare, Henrik Ibsen, Anton Chekhov, et cetera, Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, is that the text is the star. That is what is leading me. That is what I'm using as my objective. That is what I want my audience to experience. Number one. So every single word should be clear as a bell, because some tortured sucker like Tennessee Williams labored in pain over, I've always depended upon the kindness of strangers. And if it's mumbled, we're not doing it service, you see? So I'm against microphones in general, but I understand that, you know, especially in musicals, they're often required. I just hope that sound designers understand that the idea is to presence the voice rather than to manipulate the voice.
I found it really fascinating when you said that you have maybe more so now than in years past, young performers coming in who use the natural speaking volume or tone. And is that truly the case where, like, over the last recent years, you're seeing more and more of that? And do you think that has, I wonder if that has anything to do with like the TikTok generation where they're used to speaking to their phone, which is, you know, inches away from their face, where they're not having to use it to project, or if they're, you know, becoming more fascinated with the TV film idea of how, you know, how film and TV actors speak compared to live theatrical performers.
I do think all of that is a part of it. Everything you mentioned, and I think it's a great observation that you make. And I also, I think that especially at a certain age, people are very, you know, sort of impressed, I would say, by this idea of like, oh, he was so real, you know, ever since basically, I would say the Actors Studio and Marlon Brando and this kind of turn, especially in American acting, towards, as I'm going to say, the illusion of naturalism, that a lot of people have revered that over someone that, say, like Mark Rylance, who they would say, oh, well, he's sort of stylized or something, that he is, what would be the word? It's not stylized as much as it's like theatrical, which has become a kind of dirty word for a lot of people, that they think, you know, somebody just kind of talking like this and like you strain.
Even the way audience. Writers are writing now, they're writing to that.
Mm. A lot of ums and ellipses. And I think, for instance, the vocal fry. Oh, God, don't get me started on that. It's just, to me, it's not only hurts me, because for me, of course, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard, that sound, because it's so terribly unhealthy. So not only is there that element, but it also is so sad to me, because what it is it's a swallowing back of communication. So it's, you know, it's a very, you know, there's no power in it. There's no taking responsibility and saying, here's what I need to say to you. But instead, it's like, well, I'm going to say this thing to you, but I'm going to kind of inhale at the same time. So it's like it's a weird thing. It's an inhale at the same time that you're speaking. So you're not exhaling.
It's exhausting.
And there's no commitment from it whatsoever. You can always pull it further back, you know, but that's what it is. It's a variety. It's another version of the upspeak, which, you know, became so popular in the 90s. Because if I speak in declarative sentences, you might disagree with me, you know, that would be terrible. So nothing is ever spoken. Nothing is ever affirmed. There are no declarative sentences. And I hate to say this, but it's much more prevalent in women.
Carol, I remember you said that you coached corporate professionals on speaking.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that work that you do and maybe the differences between that and the theater?
Oh, sure. So I worked for a company called Piketty Consulting, and she is a therapist, a social worker, and she worked all of her life on presentation skills, and she developed a kind of workshop that basically, if you put these people through these exercises, by the end of the 16-hour period, they were vastly improved. It was a very impressive workshop. It was succinct, it was quick, and you could take a sort of young middle manager. Let's say I worked for Gray Advertising once. And, you know, they have, one of their clients is Procter & Gamble. And so I would always get the junior suite executives, and they were maybe making their very first pitch to a client as to their ideas for how to sell, I don't know, shampoo. And of course, they relied heavily on PowerPoint. They mostly faced the PowerPoint and clicked and clicked and clicked and read the slides that were up there as if we were incapable of seeing them and reading them ourselves. So it was basically, they were a bore and very, you know, mumbling a lot. And so we had to, bring them up and out of that. And we worked a lot on content as well as, you know, the voice and speech. It was funny because often I had, I'll take, for example, one group that they were hedge fund managers and young, they were, it was all men except for one woman. And they all basically made, you know, over $10 million a year. And they came into the room looking at me like, what the hell are you gonna teach me? You've got on a Banana Republic suit. I'm not impressed, you know? And they were trying to, you know, look at their phones the entire time. So the first thing I had to do was to address the elephant in the room, which was the lack of respect and the lack of commitment to the work, and get them to put their phones down and commit to the work itself. And the arrogance was finally chipped away a bit when they got up to speak, because of course they spoke terribly and they had tics and filler language, and they were terrified, these $10 million a year guys, so arrogant. And all of a sudden, they'd met their match, which was public speaking. And you could take, you know, a freshman actor from a university BFA program, and you could have them blow away a $10 million a year hedge fund manager. You know, on that playing field, we were superior. So it was interesting to take them through that and to have them humble themselves enough to realize that they needed a few skills. And so we gave them a few and improved them quite a bit. It was fascinating work and very lucrative. So that was nice too.
It's those stories I love to hear of the connection with, you know, what I learned in actor school, right? And the the real world connections that corporate people may not see where we have our strengths and how they're transferable to what they do.
Yeah. I went through a real, I guess I would say like my conscience was bothered going into teaching acting, because I was teaching people that were going into a profession where their chances for employment were exceedingly low, where we didn't need them in the workplace. You know, it's like in the workforce, we had tons of actors, people that were interested. So I had a little crisis of conscience. And then I remembered an article that when I was temping right out of grad school, I had to go get a temp job in New York. And I worked for Business Week magazine. And I was, you know, editing an article. And the article, this will really age me, was before the year 2000. And they were asking CEOs of Fortune 500 companies what they wanted for their workers in the next millennium. And they said, this was what their wish list was. Number one, the ability to communicate effectively. Okay. Number two, the ability to state an objective and to understand the obstacles in overcoming that objective. And I thought to myself, well, that's acting 101. And number three was the ability to role play and improvise. And I said, well, that's an actor. So even if these students graduate in 4 years with a BFA in acting, they can do anything. And I found that's true over and over and over again. As I went through my little temp career, wherever, whatever corporation I landed at would offer me full-time employment. And because these are the skills that they required were the very skills that we studied.
Well, it's like people skills, essentially. That's how I view it. It feels like it's people skills. Like you're learning how to, you know, be human but you're studying what it is to be a human in various forms.
Also, that other piece is this idea of what is the objective? How can I be effective in overcoming the obstacles to achieve that objective? That streamlines everything, you know? So it's a great skill to be able to do that. Yeah. A serious skill.
I was going to just pivot a little bit because you were talking about working in the corporate world and training those junior executives. Switching gears a little bit into Shakespeare, something that has always intimidated me. Again, I'm not a performer. My undergrad degree is in English literature. So I took a whole course on Shakespeare where we had to read 12 of his plays, which felt, as a theater person, felt so wrong. So I really struggled with that because I wasn't able to see it, experience it the way that it was meant to. And so going into it, just solely reading it and then having a discussion in class about it, I found the language so difficult to like really get into the world. I felt like even though I read 12 plays in 12 weeks or so, I was constantly in his world, but I just felt like the language was, I was constantly having to relearn the language every single week. So I'm curious with your experience with working with actors, working in Shakespeare, how do you advise actors and directors, theater makers to really get into the world of Shakespeare if it's not their niche?
Yeah. Well, I think very few people, you know, just come to it and find that it's their niche. You know, it's like nobody can just pick up Shakespeare and start reading it. But soft, with light through yonder window breaks. I mean, nobody just picks up that and reads it like that. So first of all, you know, the process I use is that we take the poetry, that we learn verse and what is verse and what is its presence doing there. And it, you know, there is a kind of drumbeat underneath Shakespeare that was the reason that I think so many illiterate people, which was the majority of his audience, remember, certainly everyone that was standing on the ground, that what they call the groundlings, the common people, they weren't English majors, you know, they just liked a really good story, which all of the stories are. I mean, the plots are fantastic if you just take it on that level. But he also wrote it in iambic pentameter, which is this beat, right? It's so like rap music or even pop music, it's got a certain rhythm to it that somehow gets to us on a visceral, non-intellectual level. It enters through our emotional core. And so he chose iambic pentameter because, you know, it's unaccented accented. So it's bum, 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 bum. And what is that? The human heartbeat. So he came using language that was on the same rhythm as what was inside of our bodies. So, I mean, now, did the groundlings understand this? That, oh, I see, he's writing an iambic pentameter which imitates the human heart. They didn't understand that. They just, you know, kind of like hip hop or rap. It's like, it's got this beat to it that affects us somehow. We don't have to understand it or explain it. And I think a lot of people, because they come to Shakespeare with such fear, and they are like, okay, I'm gonna do everything I can to understand what they're saying. And because they come to it that way, they don't allow the very basic idea of, oh, it's this old guy and he's got three daughters and he wants to retire. And so, you know, he does this and, oh my gosh, look what happens. I mean, kids would watch that and figure the story out and not feel stupid that they didn't understand, you know, half of the language. So I start there. I start with the verse and kind of recognizing that rhythm. And then after we recognize that rhythm, we start to understand that some words carry more meanings than others, right? And we call that the operative word, you know, to be or not to be. That is the question. And so maybe question becomes more important than to, you know, or that, to be or not to be. That is the question. No, because Shakespeare didn't write it that way. That is not what he is emphasizing with the verse. That's on an unstressed position, right? So we start to learn that. What is the operative word? Is it in the stressed position? Oh, it is. So that could be the operative word. What do you think is the second most? So secondary, tertiary. And then why does he end the verse line there? Because the sentence isn't finished. So we learn to kind of push into the next line. And in analyzing this and doing this, what I call detective work, we begin to see how he's constructed this thing. It's like pulling it apart and saying, oh, I see. So this is the foundation and these are the walls that are holding it up and this is the roof. And we get into it you know, with real curiosity and enthusiasm. And then we can begin to understand, oh, I see why he wrote it that way. And then we say, okay, so Shakespeare wrote it this way. If that's the most important word, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks? Breaks is the most important word, right? So why? Why? How does that relate back to the character? How does that become part of the character's objective? Romeo sees a light, which pulls him away from his friends, Mercutio, and everybody sort of making fun of him. He turns, he sees a light, he doesn't know why it's there, but soft. What's that? What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east. And Juliet is the sun. That is the dawning of understanding where he gets that girl I just met at the dance is standing on the balcony. And so the breath comes, right? That breath of understanding. It is the east and Juliet is the sun, right? And Shakespeare will write that in for you so that you begin to understand this guy is having a big aha moment here. It's that girl from the dance. And so much of is revealed to us by understanding how Shakespeare constructed the language. And I'm sure it's similar for musicians. It's like, why did Beethoven put a rest there? Or why is that a whole note instead of a quarter note? And when we begin to understand the construction of something, we can begin then to sort of say, oh, I see why he did that, because Romeo is having a moment of discovery. And then we can say, okay, he's got to make that connection that now he's in the Capulet's orchard. You see, and all of these things can be revealed to us as actors for having taken some time to do that detective work.
For me, that was half the fun of it, was doing the detective work.
Yeah.
Mary, would you like to move into our lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it. First question for you is, what is one thing in the theater industry that confuses you?
Casting.
What are three adjectives that describe your ideal working environment?
Open, curious, fun-loving.
Is there something in your process that you find unique to you?
My own soul, my own experiences in my life, my collection of lessons learned.
What's one job in the theater industry that you would consider trading jobs with for 1 week?
Artistic director, choosing a season. I wouldn't want all the other jobs associated with artistic director, like raising the money. But I think choosing a season would be fascinating.
What is one Shakespeare play that you've already directed or a role that you've played that you would like to have another go at?
God, there's a big long list of ones that I haven't had a shot at.
What is one that maybe you haven't gotten a chance to do?
Well, now I've aged out of so many roles. I would have liked to have had a shot at Rosalind. I was cast, but I didn't take it. And I would have liked to have played some of the male roles. I got to play Julius Caesar before COVID. And I played, the director wrote, you know, changed the pronouns. And so Julius Caesar was now a woman, the most powerful person in the world. I would love a shot at Iago, Macbeth, Lear, Prospero. All those male roles. they're bigger and they're meatier and more challenging. Even though I've played some of the great, great female roles.
What is one hobby that you have outside of the theater?
Traveling. Yeah, and it really feeds the process. I think it's, you know, it's been inspiring on so many levels.
What is the last great piece of theater you saw?
It's like, cast your mind back before COVID, because I haven't been to the theater since COVID, because now I have cancer and I'm extremely vulnerable. I have no immune system left. I know. I'm going to say it was in London, and I flew over especially to see Mark Rylance in Jerusalem. It was perhaps the most thrilling performance I've ever seen in my life. And to put it, a friend of mine who basically comes into the theater and always falls asleep, like the lights go down and he falls asleep, he was on the edge of his seat. Like it was a concert, like a rock concert for him. So that was fascinating.
I love those moments.
Carol, thank you so, so much for coming on here and sharing your words of wisdom with us. It was really amazing to see you again and hear some stories. I love hearing your stories, really.
Yeah, it's fun to tell them. Sometimes you get so carried away that you don't get on with your work in class. But yeah, it's been a joy, guys. It's fun.
Thank you so much. It was so great to meet you virtually, of course. I'm actually a little bummed that during my time at Montclair that we didn't cross paths at all.
Me too.
I was there for a master's program. But it was nice to get to chat with you as well. So thank you. Thank you.
Of course. My pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Page to Stage. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Page to Stage Podcast.
And if you're enjoying these conversations, we would really appreciate it if you could take a couple minutes to rate and review us wherever you're listening to this podcast. Until next time.
That's Brian.
That's Mary.
We'll see you later.
Bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the Rise Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RiseTheatre.org, because only together we rise.